Good evening, and welcome to the Mutual Fund Observer conversation with Morty Shaya and Mitch Rubin of River Park Funds. All participants will be in listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, please signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. After today's presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. Please note, this event is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to David Snowball. Please go ahead, sir.
Great. Thanks, Laura. And hi, guys. Welcome to the Observer's Chat with Mitch Rubin, Chief Investment Officer and Manager of River Park Large Growth Fund, and Morty Shaya, CEO of the River Park Funds. As a special holiday surprise, we've also decided to throw in Conrad Van Tienhoven, who has worked now for 14 years with Mitch, and who is the Assistant Portfolio Manager for the Large Growth Fund. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
I wanted to begin with the obvious, you know, my conviction that about 80% of all mutual funds could shut their doors today and no one would miss them other than perhaps the managers and their moms. If I had to describe them, I'd use words like, you know, large, unimaginative, undistinguished, cowardly asset sponges. Most of them thrive by never being bad enough to dump. And so year after year, their numbers swell. By one estimate, a third of all mutual fund assets are now invested in closet index funds, about a third in actual index funds, and only that final third in funds that are actually active. Sadly, the large and slow-moving tend to win analyst coverage and investor attention. The Observer writes, though, for the benefit of intellectually curious, serious investors, managers, advisors, individuals who want to go beyond the obvious, beyond the marketing fluff, and beyond computer-generated recommendations, which is one of the things that led us to ask Mitch, Morty, and Conrad if they would join us for an hour this evening. By way of introduction, I'll say that it's easy to misread the River Park Large Growth Fund, at least at first glance. Its modest track record masks the much longer public record of accomplishment that its manager can lay claim to, going back about, I think, 20 years to the start of his association with Barron Asset Management. And while the fund currently sports a modest three-star rating and a modest three-year return, those more reflect its rocky 2014, but masks outstanding performance in 2012 and 2013 and 2011. That is to say, a consistent pattern of excellence. Our plan is to devote the first third of our hour together to an introduction to the fund, the middle third to my chat with Mitch, Morty, and Conrad, and the final third to your questions. As we approach that last third, Laura will give you instructions about how you could get in the queue to speak directly to the guys. For now, though, I would like to welcome Morty Shaya.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure being part of this conference call. So I just wanted to set the table a little bit on terms of, you know, what I'd, you know, like to focus on tonight. And that's that, you know, if you look at this fund, the River Park Large Growth Fund, you know, it's 4 years old. If you look at the first 3 years of its performance, you know, obviously stellar performance, you know, top decile performance. And yet in the fourth year, in this year, 2014, it's had, quote-unquote, lackluster performance. It's up only 3% in a strong market. And while we're excited about the fact that we've delivered 20% a year on average for the last 3 years, including this year, it is a struggle this year. And what I really want to focus on is why, how, where, but more importantly, what does that mean for next year? And as we look at companies, and I'm going to give you the general, you know, parameters, and I'll let Mitch and Conrad go into more detail and where the opportunities are. But as we look at the portfolio, we're always asking the question, are the companies we're investing in, are they performing better, stronger than the stock price, or the opposite? Is the stock price outperforming the business, or is the business outperforming the stock price? And if you look at, and in most years, you've got some stocks that are doing better than the business, and other, you know, and other stocks that are obviously, you know, the other side. If you look at 2014, on, you know, the vast majority of our companies had spectacular years in terms of their business operations, their earnings growth, and yet their stock prices actually lagged behind the businesses. Said differently, even though the market has experienced multiple appreciation, you know, the multiple of the market has gone up, you know, we've actually experienced contraction of multiple. So our stocks haven't gotten the attention of investors. And frankly, that's where the opportunity is. Because all of a sudden, you know, we look at our businesses, and if you look at the portfolio in the aggregate, it's trading at about a 16 multiple off of, you know, 1 year forward earnings for 20% growth. 16 multiple, 20% growth. The market overall is trading at about the same multiple for only 7% forward 5 year growth. So you're buying for the same price, you're buying, you know, roughly three times the growth, and that's the opportunity. So, you know, the other, I think, you know, point I'd like to make, just as you think about, you know, the remarks that, you know, Mitch and Conrad are going to give, is that often your stocks that have the that perform the worst 1 year, okay, give rise to the best performance the next year, and that's of course if you maintain the same conviction in the long term opportunity. And, you know, the challenge for us as portfolio managers is to recognize those underperforming stocks and say, my God, what, boy, we have, you know, that's a fantastic opportunity. We're going to increase our investment in those stocks and then not only have the opportunity that we own them, but have the opportunity that we own more of them. And more often than not, those are the stocks that are going to generate the performance the next year. The in 2014, we've got not just one, two, three, or five of those opportunities. We have many of those opportunities, and that's what's giving us sort of the excitement going into next year, because we're looking at this portfolio, and we're not just seeing one, two, three, five, ten unbelievable, exciting opportunities. We're seeing many opportunities. The last point I'd like to make is that, you know, we often get asked questions, you know, for the last 20 years, how do you buy a great business? How do you buy a business that you think is going to double its earnings over the next, you know, 4 or 5 years? How do you buy those businesses at an attractive price? Isn't the market efficient enough that you're not going to be given that opportunity? And our answer to that is that, you know, we tend to look at businesses with a time horizon measured in years, meaning we're looking at a business 2, 3, 4, 5 years out, and the market overall focuses much more short term. They're focusing on this month, this quarter, maybe this year. And when you get different results, when those things don't rhyme together, when the short-term events are negative or there's some kind of a short-term, you know, headwind, and if that doesn't change your conviction about the long-term success of those businesses, that's what gives you those unbelievable opportunities to sort of, you know, buy a great business at an attractive price, because something in the short term is affecting the stock price and you can take advantage of it. And we've got, again, numerous examples of those in our portfolio as well this year. So, yeah, are we troubled or upset that, you know, we're only up, you know, 3% this year and, you know, in a strong market? Yeah, of course. You know, we've got a lot of our own money invested in this fund, you know, as, you know, alongside shareholders. But the more importantly, I think, you know, the message I think we want to deliver is that that's what's giving rise to this unbelievable excitement that we have to be shareholders, you know, in the year going forward. So that's my introduction, and you know, and what I really hope to do is to have Mitch and Conrad share with you some of these exciting ideas and why we're so excited about the portfolio. So with that, Mitch, it's all yours.
Okay, great. I'm not sure I'd need to add to that. I think maybe, you know, the way I'd like to begin explaining what it is we do, and then maybe tee up a few of the examples within the fund that highlight the opportunity that Morty just described, is, you know, from a background perspective, our team's been doing this, as David said, for 20 years, and we've been consistently managing growth stock portfolios during that time. And I would say the underlying core of what we believe in is that it, as long-term investors, as Morty said, there's this time arbitrage between short-term events and the long-term value of a company. And if we find great growth businesses that have the opportunity to double their earnings over a reasonable 4 to 6 year period, but we can wait patiently to buy them at great prices, then we can take the best of value strategies to investing, combine it with the best of growth stock investing, and have a portfolio that can consistently double our clients' money every 4 to 6 years, while also having the conviction, you know, in years where the portfolio underperforms or the market is tough, to double down in our companies, because those are often the best times to set yourself up for future returns. And so how do we do this? Year after year after year, we focus almost all of our time and effort on a few key factors. And they are not the current trends in the market, interest rates, oil prices, things like that. It is, first of all, where can we find companies that are benefiting from well-established, long-term, secular economic trends? These are things that are expanding market opportunity and profit potential, irrespective of current global macro events. These are things such as mobile computing, wireless and internet traffic growth, electronic payments, global food demand, global travel, the demand for alternative asset management, things where over the next 5, 6, 7, 10 years, our children are going to be doing much more of these things than we did or our parents did. So massively expanding markets. And within those markets, we look for the companies, the market-leading companies that are the leaders or the potential leaders of these trends. And then we focus on ground-up, one-by-one, fundamental stock-specific research on these companies. And we're looking for the businesses that have substantial and growing earnings, high margin, strong free cash flow, run by management teams that we get to know and can delineate between those that have a great ability to adapt and manage capital and manage through good and hard times, and maybe most importantly for times of distress, companies with fortress balance sheets. And if we can find great secular business opportunities with markets that are expanding dramatically, and then high margin, high free cash flow, high return businesses run by great management teams, then we build a pantry of those businesses and we wait patiently to buy them at great prices. So you can find lots of high growth businesses today, but a lot of them trade at huge momentum multiples, which means that in tough times, you know, you can have a huge contraction in value even if the company meets its expectations. So we wait patiently to say, from a value orientation, if we can buy these companies at reasonable prices, and reasonable to us means a traditional market multiple, 15, 16 times forward earnings for 20% or better growth, especially if it's all free cash, we don't need to wait for the cheapest possible price, but we will not, we very much subscribe to the theory that a great investment in a great company only happens if you also do it at a great price. So by marrying the best of value investing, which is to wait for a great price and be really patient, with the best of investing in growth companies that have the opportunity to double and triple in size, then it would be, we have a high degree of confidence that every 4 to 5 years we're going to double our clients' money. Now that may or may not keep pace with the market. If the market's ripping, we expect it to beat the market over time, but the fundamental focus of our investment process is finding great businesses that we can buy at great prices. So let me take a breath there and see Morty or David, if there you want me to jump right into examples, or do you want me to expound on the strategy a little bit?
No, Mitch, I would love you to just go right into, you know, what are compelling businesses and, you know, why are they cheap? What's the opportunity?
Great. So let's take one of our largest holdings, which is a stock that hasn't participated in the market this year, but is maybe the perfect example of how you can buy, you know, a phenomenal growth company at an unbelievable price. So we've been an owner of a firm called Blackstone, which is a investment manager. It's an alternative investment manager. It came public in 2007, but the business has been around for about 25 years. It actually, you know, I was started my career as a corporate lawyer, and Blackstone was one of my early clients. So I've known the guys at the company for a very long time. They are by far the largest alternative asset manager at $250 billion of assets under management, but by global asset managers, that's an incredibly small amount of capital. So if you think about assets at Schwab that are topping close to $2 trillion or BlackRock that are $3 trillion or T. Rowe Price that are at $1.5 trillion, you have a $250 billion asset manager, which, and those assets under management have doubled since the company's IPO in 2007. So 100% growth in assets under management and a stock price that is flat since its IPO. So the stock traded down sharply in the sell-off in 2008 and 2009 and really has only recovered back to its IPO price. And this is despite growing assets under management 25% a year, growing its dividend 200%. They had a distribution, even just the last 4 years, they had a distribution of 50 cents in 2011, and it's currently $2. Their earnings power is a function of the assets under management and the quality of their returns, and they are a top decile manager in each of their strategies, private equity, real estate, fund of funds, and credit. It's a global business. Over 70% of the new capital raised has gone into new strategies, so it's not just a historical private equity business where they came, but they've really grown dramatically. And they have the benefit of two core aspects that we look for in a secular growth company. One, the core opportunity is growing dramatically in that capitalism, as it's marched across the world, has created a global opportunity to buy businesses and a global pool of capital looking to be managed. The low interest rate environment has massively increased the demand for alternative managers. So most large pension funds and endowments have dramatically increased their allocation to alternative managers. And that's at the same time that many of the competitors in the alternative management business, namely the large diversified investment banks and commercial banks, have had to get out of the business in the post-2007-2008 regulatory environment. So you have a high-growth company, new product-oriented, very well diversified, very high margins. At the parent company, you have no debt and tremendous excess capital and book value, and yet it trades at 9x earnings. The business, to us, is as great an example of where you can find a tremendous long-term growth company at an inexpensive multiple, but you have to be able to independently do your work. The company has only been public for 6 or 7 years. It's a relatively new business format in that it's a MLP, which many people haven't seen in investment in public companies. As a result, its earnings and its P&L don't neatly reflect something like T. Rowe Price or something where you have a very simple flow of fees to profits. And that complexity combined with the volatility in the markets over the last year is what's given us the opportunity to buy that company at such a cheap price. It's also a great example of how while the stock has appreciated since we bought it, we bought the stock very well when it fell dramatically from its IPO, it's been a significant laggard this year. And you know, when your largest holder is holding is relatively flat, it's hard for your fund to outperform. For the next 5 years, we expect Blackstone to continue to grow assets at a 15 to 20% clip. We expect their core fees, realized performance fees, and incentive fees all to grow over time and grow significantly. And we expect their dividends to continue to grow at 15 to 20% a year. And again, you're getting all that for 9x earnings with a 5% dividend yield.
So Mitch, that's a great example of a company where the answer to why can we buy it at an attractive price is it's confusing, it's misunderstood. You know, that's, you know, you're going down that path. Let's do an example. You know, I promised David that we would talk about Macau, and there's an example of where there's a, you know, two different time horizons. Maybe that's, you know, maybe you can talk about your visit to Macau.
Yeah, so we've been investors in the gaming business and the casino business for 20 years. We've been through the move from Atlantic City, the creation of the Las Vegas Strip, the really evolution of casinos from you know, slot parlors and card games to integrated entertainment destination resorts. And that evolution has now gone international. And so where two-thirds of the world's gaming revenue was done in the United States up until about 5 or 6 years ago, Macau is now the leading destination gaming region in the world. The growth in Macau is one of the most unbelievable growth stories of the last 15 years. So go back to 2005, and there was $3 or $4 billion of gambling being done in Macau, which is a little peninsula off the coast of China, mostly in smoky, totally unrenovated gambling halls. As the Macau government decided, in the growth of China in general, the Chinese and Macau government wanted to bring world-class destination resorts to China, not just for the growth of their middle class and upper class, but to, introduce China as a destination for the world. They've invested substantial infrastructure in making Macau one of the great destinations in China, and they've invited in outside investors by giving out several licenses for people to build casinos there. Sheldon Adelson and Steve Wynn from Las Vegas Sands and Wynn in Las Vegas, Steve Wynn as the original builder of Mirage and Bellagio and the first integrated resort, and Sheldon Adelson as really the first to marry the convention and mall business with the resort, were two of the leading concession winners. And where 10 years ago, before these guys built buildings, there was $3 to $4 billion of gaming win being done in Macau, now the Venetian Macau itself does over $5 billion of revenue. And the revenue is being done in a much more diversified way. So we've built malls, hotel rooms, high-end restaurants. In addition to that, the Chinese government over the last couple of years and the next 5 years is spending upwards of $500 billion to increase the access to Macau. So between building literally a bridge from the Hong Kong airport directly to Macau, which is over 30 miles of water, which is being accomplished, they're two-thirds of the way done with this $20 billion project. It'll take the time to get from the Hong Kong airport, which is the busiest airport in the world, from 2 to 3 hours by ferry to 20 minutes by car. They're spending $100 billion a year, literally, to build light rails from the Chinese provinces out to the coast. They've brought in the gates from which you get from mainland China to Macau, which is essentially like going from New Jersey to New York. It's just separated by a small body of water that you go over a bridge or can walk over through land. Right now, those gates are only open 6 to 8 hours a day, and they're going to be open 24 hours a day, and all of the ferry terminals are doubling in size. So that increased infrastructure is also being expanded by increasing the bed base dramatically. Again, the government of China on the island directly across from the island of Macau is essentially over the next 4 years building Orlando. No gaming licenses, but a $50 billion investment in infrastructure to create family-oriented resorts. And all of that increase in transportation infrastructure and access is being used to fill what is going from 28,000 hotel rooms today in Macau to 35,000 hotel rooms over the next 3 to 4 years, being built by the casino companies that we're invested in. And that compares to 150,000 hotel rooms just in Las Vegas. So even at the end of a doubling of the rooms in Macau, we believe that the demand to visit Macau is going up by 5 to 7-fold, all paid for by the Chinese government. This year, and so we've owned these stocks off and on. They've been incredibly volatile stocks doing business in China obviously has its risk. And also, over the years, these companies were mostly financed with high-yield debt. And any hiccup in either the global economy or in the Chinese economy would lead to these huge swings in the value of these companies. So over the last 4 or 5 years, as the first tranche of resorts have opened, the companies have shifted from being high-yield and risky businesses to fortress balance sheets, mostly without debt, mostly paying very high dividends, and strong free cash generators. This year and last year, we bought the stocks after a similar swoon a couple of years ago. They were very strong stocks last year. We had small positions. This year, they've sold off dramatically, on average down 20 to 30%, some of the other stocks down 30 to 40%, mostly in response to a change in perspective of the Chinese government towards an anti-corruption campaign throughout China, mostly directed at Premier Xi kind of consolidating his power as he transitions into, you know, being more of a director of that economy over the next decade. And that transition has led to almost a similar kind of stall in the high-end gambler going to Macau, and just at the VIP level, over the last 6 to 8 months. And so where gaming revenue at the VIP level was growing 20 to 30% a year for the last 4 or 5 years, it's contracting by 15 to 20% currently. And that's put a dramatic cloud over these stocks and caused these huge sell-offs that we're taking advantage of. Now, these are businesses where we believe the transition to a more mass-driven market is really the core of our investment thesis. Las Vegas Sands built a property in Singapore, which is much more of a mass-driven market. They built the property for $3 billion, and it's doing $1.5 billion of EBITDA in a very broad mass market approach to the consumer. And that property is, you know, at a 50% return on capital is a core driver of the excess cash being invested to build the casinos in Macau. The VIP gambler, you make about a 12% margin on, but the mass gambler, you make a 50% margin on. And we believe that through this transition, even though 2015 and the first few months here of 2015 may be tough year-over-year compares, the opportunity to buy these stocks at what is now about 10 or 12 times free cash flow on the current buildings, and we get the new buildings for free, which double the footprint of the companies. And at the end of the new buildings being built, which are all being built out of cash, the companies will essentially have no debt. And even, you know, if the EBITDA has some volatility over the next couple of years, they'll be tremendous, tremendous free cash generators. And so that opportunity, and these are unlike a Chinese internet company or something where they're, the asset that you own is ethereal. These are 40-year tangible assets in the ground, owned in fee by these companies.
Great. So you said a week there, Mitch, or?
Yeah. So you know, our modus operandi is when there's a company that's not, where the stock isn't performing well and there's some near-term noise, rather than listen to Wall Street or read the newspaper, we get on a plane and we go visit. And so Conrad and I, you know, spent last weekend and the first 4 days of last week, so about 4 days, 5 days on the ground. It takes about 2.5 days to get there. In both Hong Kong and Macau, interviewing business owners, we met with 7 casino managers. We met with some Chinese tourism officials. We toured the island with a Macau national. And, you know, we not only toured the infrastructure projects to see the scale and that the, you know, the cranes were actually moving, but I think to get the sense of this differential between the VIP gambler, that mass gambler, and what's really happening on the ground with the average mass affluent Chinese tourist. What I would say, a couple of observations. One, there are a lot of people in China. So there's 1.4 billion people in China. The growth of Chinese outbound travel is the largest population growth traveling in the world. So it's gone from 80 million people traveling a year to over 200. The visits to Macau have gone from 11 million a year to 30. The Chinese culture is one of challenging luck and superstition. So the desire to gamble and challenge luck is embedded in their culture. So the propensity to challenge luck is something, you know, that is a dramatic and core part of their culture. They don't necessarily view it as a sin as we do here, but a really sort of a reasonable form of entertainment. The desire for branded goods and for the experience of a casino is incredibly high. So one of the untold stories of Macau is the incredible power of the retail businesses that these companies own. So Las Vegas Sands, who's the biggest integrated resort, you know, they own 9,000 rooms in the market, so they have about a third market share. They also have a couple of million square feet of retail space. The average high-end mall in America does about $900 a foot in sales and grows about 3 or 4% a year. The average jewelry store, which would be considered, you know, high revenue per square foot, does 3 or 4,000. An Apple store does about 4,000, if you can imagine the crowdedness and the average purchase price at an Apple store. The entire mall at the Las Vegas Sands, even with the VIP restrictions in place, is doing $7,000 a foot in revenue. And growing 15 to 20% same store sales. The mall itself, if the company decided to take it public either in Hong Kong or Japan at a 5 or 6% cap rate where REITs are trading there, would be about $20 billion in value on a $60 billion market cap company. So the health of the market to us is incredibly strong, and the potential for these businesses to earn high returns is very high, and they have the balance sheet to weather this current storm.
Okay. We're about halfway through the hour, Mitch, and so I thought what I might do is just check in with you on a couple things that I was curious about and then give the folks who've been listening a chance to talk with you as well.
Great.
Does that make sense? And so why don't we stay with Macau for just a minute. You were there on the ground 4 or 5 days. I was sort of wondering if you could give us folks a sense of what you learned there, what you know now that you didn't know beforehand. I'm guessing there are a lot of people in China, they spend a lot of money, wasn't entirely news to you. Are there things that you actually walked away from the trip going, oh, goodness, we got to work on this?
Yeah, I think the two large takeaways were that I believe this anti-corruption crackdown is something that is going to be with us for some time,
mm-hmm.
and is the new normal. And therefore, the casinos move to mass. I think in many ways, the managers of these casinos have had the easy money of VIP gamblers, and that's led to all of the properties doing well. And what we
mm-hmm.
learned from Las Vegas, and what we think will happen in Macau, is that transition to mass is the core to long-term sustainable underwritable profits and higher multiples so that there's less volatility. And only
okay.
the best-run property managers with the product that is most integrated is going to win that battle. And so that gave us a lot of conviction in the properties that we own that have a long history of running integrated resorts as opposed to just gambling halls. That's
mm-hmm.
one. The second is, I don't think you can truly appreciate the scale of the infrastructure that the Chinese government is investing in unless you're there on the ground. The amount of dirt being moved, cement being poured, just the sheer engineering of this bridge, having taken that ferry several times over the years, and the promise now seeing it tangibly of this bridge two-thirds of the way built, the amount of cars waiting at the gate to come in, the scale of this development in Hengqin Island, to look at that, to imagine, you know, Orlando next to Las Vegas and what that would do for the amount of traffic in the casinos.
Right.
So I think it galvanized for us that even with the additional, you know, 20,000 rooms that's being built, the market is going to be dramatically underserved for the amount of people that are going to go there. And
sure.
that the other thing that I think was a real eye-opener for us was how that propensity to gamble translated into the tables. In the U.S., you can find a table in any market for $5 or $10 to make a bet. And almost all of the tables in Macau are $60, $100 and up, being played 7 deep by the average tourist. So not just the high-end gambler in the back rooms, but that propensity to gamble, seeing it real-time, even while the market's struggling, was an
mm-hmm.
eye-opener.
Okay. One of the things that I was curious about, Mitch, is this kind of sense of international diversification in the portfolio. If you look just at a simple where are they domiciled kind of analysis, you'd reach the conclusion that you have a purely domestic portfolio, but we know that that's silly because U.S. domiciled companies make their money in the rest of the world and I guess to some extent then become a little more hostage to the activities there. I didn't know if you'd talk to us about, as you think about it, where the earnings in your portfolio are coming from and whether that creates risks or benefits that wouldn't be obvious from a simple, oh, it's a domestic stock fund.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, David. I mean, we vastly prefer U.S. GAAP and U.S. dollar accounting. and mm-hmm. U.S. property rules, which is why we tend to buy U.S. listed stocks. But a lot of the themes that we invest in are global, and a lot of that global growth is even more aggressive outside of the U.S. And so the vast majority of the businesses we own are international, where 40 to 50% of their revenue comes from international markets. So whether that's Google and eBay, which are 60% international, Priceline, which is 75% international, Visa and MasterCard in the payment space, that's 40% international. Obviously, the casinos, all of that growth is in China. The financial exchanges, CME and ICE, Apple. So I would say two-thirds of our companies have half of their revenue growth coming internationally, and it does present other things for us to worry about. The simplest is currency translation. So at a time where the U.S. dollar has been really strong, even if a company with strong international growth is doing well, they're likely to miss the quarter on a currency translation issue, which oftentimes hits the stock and gives us a chance to buy. The other thing is just to stay on top of changing rules and regulations. So we don't have a lot of emerging market exposure, but Visa and MasterCard, for example, have small and emerging businesses in Russia that we, you know, is not a good idea to underwrite those businesses growing anytime soon. Obviously, mm-hmm. Schlumberger as an international energy company, is somewhat constrained by the complexity of geopolitical events in a lot of the regions in the world that they're drilling for oil, not to mention just the global price of oil.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we need to have a global perspective of both the risk we're embracing in the businesses we own that might be unwitting by having some international companies, and also just the added complexity of having global businesses. But that's what gives us the opportunity, you know, to find extraordinary growth businesses and use that complexity to buy them when they're out of favor.
Okay. Morty, go for it.
I was just going to, you know, one big area that we haven't touched upon that's been in the news that, you know, the energy, you know, oil prices, gas prices, and, you know, we've been sort of close to more gas than oil in recent years. And Mitch, do you want to just comment briefly on something like that before we open it up to Q&A, you know, to the outside, or?
Yeah, so we have about 13% of the fund in energy-focused companies, which would seem scary at a time where gas prices have plummeted. Strangely, our oil prices. Our oil stocks have held up great, and we've had a chance to buy them at great prices, and there's Schlumberger and EOG are our core holdings. It's really the natural gas stocks that have been a headwind for us this year. We own two businesses, Southwestern Gas and Cabot. Both have huge footprints in the Marcellus Shale, and then Southwestern also has a huge footprint in the Fayetteville Shale. Both of these companies dramatically underlevered in terms of balance sheet debt and substantial growth. The price of gas has declined over the last 15 years from $5 an MCF down to a little under $4 today. And at $4 gas, these companies make 50% profit margins because they are the most prolific, vertically integrated, lowest cost companies that also are drilling for gas near some of the highest use regions. These stocks in particular, not gas has somewhat caught the cold of oil, but the Marcellus, which is probably the best gas rock in America, is burdened by not having enough pipeline access coming out of it. So both mm-hmm. companies are currently selling their gas at a discount as they drill it, and the drilling growth is 50% a year. And there's several pipeline projects opening over the next 2 years, one of which was just formally approved over the last few weeks, which will solve that differential. So not only do we think gas, which is a huge growth usage commodity in America, not just for LNG, so gas globally trades at about $11 or $12 an MCF, and in the U.S. it trades at $4, which means as we get the ability to liquefy it, we can sell more on the international markets over time. And there's legislative and other changes that have to occur for that. But as a replacement fuel for coal, as a replacement fuel and a peaking fuel in electricity production, in car production, gas is a huge growth usage commodity in this country. And fracking and the use of technology, especially for the vertically integrated, under-leveraged companies, has allowed them to have this dramatic production growth. And again, You know, these are companies that were essentially flat in their stocks over the last 3 or 4 years for 30 to 40% production growth. And with unlevered balance sheets, the opportunity to take advantage of disrupted markets, you know, while other companies are playing defense, our guys are playing offense. And we feel like for the next 4 or 5 years, these are tremendous, tremendous values.
Okay. Hey, Laura, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good. Good to hear from you. I was wondering if you could do us a favor. I had one more question for the guys, and then I thought we would open the floor to listeners. Could you take a second and let the folks know how they could get in queue for a question?
Certainly. To ask a question, you may press star, then one on your touch-tone phone. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the keys. To withdraw your question, please press star, then two. Again, it is star, then one if you'd like to ask a question.
Cool, thank you. I'll ask one last question, and then I'll check back with you, Laura, to see if there are folks who would like to join in. And so I was curious, one of the things that you had mentioned, Mitch, is that a couple of the holdings that you had highlighted pay kind of rich and quickly growing dividends. I was wondering if, given that, we should be surprised that the fund seems to have no yield. It's a, you know, a tiny fraction of a percent on its income generation.
Yeah, it's really an anomaly for us that several of our companies have strong yields in that, you know, for the most part, we prefer high growth companies that have opportunities to invest, you know, to reinvest that capital, you know, in high returning projects. And yet, you know, with Blackstone with a 5% yield, or some of the gaming stocks with strong yields, or even Apple with a decent yield, I believe, you know, most of that dividend yield has been really highlighted this year, in that some of those dividend paying companies have been among the worst performers, and they've also been the largest increasers of their dividends. So, you know, as troubled as these Macau stocks have been, the guys just increased their dividends 20 and 30%. The Blackstone mm-hmm. dividend just jumped dramatically. The Apple dividend jumped dramatically this year. So
sure.
I think that historic yield is an anomaly that doesn't really capture the increase in the dividend yields and maybe the performance of some of the stocks over the last 6 months.
Right. I was just kind of curious, if the stocks have a high yield, should the fund have a yield as well, or is that just sort of most of the stocks in the portfolio don't, and it's just these few anomalous ones that do?
Yeah, I think it's more the latter, David.
Okay, cool. Laura, did we have folks online?
We do not have any questions at this time, but I'll just repeat one more time that it is star then one to ask a question. Oh, and we actually do have a question now from Dan Shine. Please go ahead.
Hi, I wanted to thank you all for having this discussion. When I just looked on the summary prospectus, it indicated you had a portfolio turnover of about 45%, and it seems to me that you're in for long-term holding of your equities. I wanted to ask, with a 45 or so percent turnover, how do you reconcile that with the philosophy to be long-term with your equities?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Dan. So the turnover of names is quite low. So if you looked at the names in the portfolio since inception, 70% of the portfolio was in the portfolio at day one. The turnover really speaks to some of us managing around the volatility in any given year. So 2 years ago, we sold down some of our stronger performing stocks to increase our positions in Apple and Equinix, or Dollar Tree, which became Top Holdings, or Blackstone. This year, we've been now selling down some Apple and Equinix, which have been among our stronger performers, to increase our allocations to the casino stocks and the energy stocks. So that 45% turnover is more indicative of internal tactically selling down some of the winners to buy some of the losers and reset us up for future growth than actually selling things out of the portfolio. This year we only have two stocks that have left the portfolio and two or three that have joined.
Thank you very much.
Do we have another question, Laura?
We do not at this time.
David, I've got one if you want.
Mm-hmm.
The you know, I want to sort of bring Conrad into this. I'm assuming Conrad's still there. Are you there, Conrad?
I'm here, Morty.
Great. So the you know, the we've got a bunch of these companies in the portfolio are ones, Conrad, that you've spent a lot of time on that are, you know, classic growth companies, internet related. I'm thinking things like Google and Qualcomm, and, you know, companies that frankly haven't performed well this year, even though, you know, the businesses have done well, the stocks haven't. And maybe you can sort of talk to those opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of the, you know, it's funny to call them traditional internets now because they were, you know, these were the bleeding edge just not that long ago. But I would just, you know, Google is probably the most interesting one to talk about there. I mean, Priceline is growing dramatically and has a good valuation and hasn't performed well. And Qualcomm is, you know, what I would describe as dirt cheap. But Google is one of these names that you, I think you rarely are able to find one of the greatest growth names, you know, in the world, really. I mean, it's a 50% international revenue business, trading at 14 times earnings or 7.5 times EBITDA. And I, you know, if you look at Google's business, and most people know what Google does. I mean, they're the market share leader in global search. They have 70% market share. That's been basically steady at 70% for a decade. They're still growing clicks in that business at 20%. They're growing revenue in that business close to 20%. But they're also the, you know, by far market share leader in the fastest growing part of the internet, which is global, which is internet video, through their YouTube asset. And they own the most widely distributed mobile operating system, Android, which they've, you know, barely even begun to monetize, really only through mobile search. And I think what's happening in internet is a lot of the newer names that are, you know, they're perceived to be taking share, or they're the new shiny toy. And some of these businesses are great, like Facebook, which we have a very small position in, which we recently initiated. But Google has been kind of forgotten. And it's our biggest position right now. It is the easiest company to make a growth and valuation argument for. You know, we see earnings doubling over the next 5 years, and you're buying it at a, you know, 10 to 15% discount to the market.
Thank you, Conrad.
Great. Anyone, Laura?
No, there is no one else at this time.
They're wimps. So you'd mentioned that you have had a couple or three names leave the portfolio. Didn't know if you could give us a sense about what it takes for you to reach that decision, Mitch. Is it primarily valuation, that is, they've gotten too rich, or you've decided that the management team has lost its way, or what?
Yeah, there's basically two ways for us to decide to move along from a name. The first and foremost is that we no longer have confidence that the business is going to double. Maybe there's been a strategic shift, a management focus shift, a competitive dynamic change. And the other is simply valuation. I mean, we, to the other callers, question, we run a low turnover strategy, but that the goal is not to have a low turnover fund. The goal is to have a, at all times, attractively valued pool of growth stocks. And for the most part, the stocks we've sold over the last couple of years, the valuation has gotten away from us. So we had a small position in a beauty retailer, Ulta Beauty. It's one of our favorite retailers, an unbelievable growth stock. We were able to buy it after a 50% break about 16 months ago. The company was struggling with some same-store sales issues in the short term, had a new management team, which we thought was phenomenal. We agreed with their strategy to slow store openings and really focus on the core. The business rebounded sharply to the point that the stock, you know, nearly doubled in a very short period of time, and at 30 times earnings, we really felt like the value that we were looking for in the company was fully reflected in the stock price. Similarly, okay. Illumina, which is one of our favorite healthcare companies, unbelievable long-term opportunity, you know, doubled in a very short period of time. It's actually doubled again since we sold it. But when things reach 30, 40, 50 times earnings, even if we love the business, we sell it. Occasionally, there are okay. businesses that you know, we change our mind and we think the business – opportunity isn't as great as we see going forward. Much more rare, but an example over the last couple of years would be something like Coach, which is a retailer we've owned since small cap. And between the competition from Coors and others, and maybe that handbag secular trend running its course, we exited, you know, much higher than the current stock price, and you know, and have moved on to other ideas.
Okay, that seems fair. Laura? Laura.
Yes, I'm still here. Yes. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, press star then one. But we do not currently have any questions in the queue.
Cool. Let me know if we do. Mitch, I was kind of wondering about how we should think about volatility, or whether, as you put the portfolio together, you folks think about it. You had mentioned that it's been kind of a roller coaster year for some of the firms in the portfolio. Is your basic view that just comes with the territory, and so you don't fret about it, or do you actively attempt to manage the volatility down?
Yeah, we don't. I would say we think about volatility a couple of ways. The first and most important is, what is the potential volatility of the outcome of the business case? So what is the predictability of the earnings? How is the company financed? And what's our confidence in the management team?
Okay.
And here we draw a lot of conviction from, we tend to own recurring revenue businesses, and we tend to own businesses with little to no debt. So even if the world is a volatile place, or something like energy prices can be very volatile in the short term, if you own businesses that are cash rich, high margin, well managed, they tend to be able to look through the volatility and take advantage of it as a business. So whether it's Perrigo being able to buy a European healthcare company incredibly cheap, Schlumberger being able to manage through this downturn in oil prices, or EOG, both of which have less than one turn of debt on 50 billion market cap companies, or 100 billion in the case of Schlumberger. And so we prefer, even though our stocks can be volatile, we prefer businesses that are not volatile and incredibly well financed. Some would say stupidly financed, in that they really are under levered, but we sleep very well at night with that lack of leverage. In terms of stock price volatility, We want to always be in a position to play offense. And so one of the reasons we keep the fund reasonably diversified is that on any given day, a stock could fall 15 or 20%, and we want to be able to take advantage of that. So by maintaining, you know, reasonably small-sized positions, only be full in a stock when we think the valuation is at an absolute floor. So when things like the casino stocks or some of our nat gas stocks have these changes in valuation that are reasonably aggressive, we can take advantage of it.
David,
okay,
I've got the luxury. I've got the luxury of throwing like a lob pitch, you know, to Mitch. So Mitch, how are we positioned for potentially rising interest rates?
Right. Yeah. Thank you for that, Morty. So you know, one of the headwinds of the last few years has been in a very low interest rate environment, it encourages multiple expansion and it encourages financial engineering. So for cash-rich companies, low interest rates are a headwind, if you can believe it, because they earn nothing on their cash. And also, for the most part, our fund, you know, which has now just kept pace with the market, which is disappointing to us, but we've hit our marks in terms of compounding at high teens or better. But we've gotten there through earnings growth on no leverage, where the market. Weaker balance sheet businesses have vastly outperformed strong balance sheet companies, and the market's enjoyed significant multiple expansion. Secondly, because our businesses are cash rich, rising interest rates help. But on top of that, we own very asset rich companies for which rising interest rates are a benefit. So things like Schwab and Ameritrade, which are earning zero on all of the short-term fixed income assets, either risk-free assets or managing money market funds. Things like CME and ICE with huge business and interest rate futures that don't trade with a lot of volatility when there's no perception of changing interest rates. And frankly, businesses, you know, sitting on huge pools of cash where a rising interest rate will take, you know, $50 billion of cash at Google from earning zero to earning 2, 3, 4%.
Okay.
You know, that's going to be a headwind for a lot of other funds because generally higher interest rates slow down growth. Now, for 20% growers, a marginal slowdown in GDP doesn't really impact them, but for 1% to 2% growers, a marginal slowdown in GDP does. And higher costs of financing for other businesses also crimps their ability to grow. So I think from our perspective, rising interest rates will not hurt our ability to produce returns, but will certainly help our ability you know, in terms of relative performance.
Okay, great. Anyone, Laura?
No, we have no one in the queue.
Well, then I think we will probably wrap the call up. I wanted to take a second, if I could, to thank Mitch and Morty and Conrad and all the folks listening for your time tonight. A recording of this call, a profile of the River Park Large Growth Fund, and an audio version of that profile will all be available on the at the Observer on January 1st. We'll offer highlights and a link to the MP3 on the Observer's discussion board, which you're all invited, sometime within the next 48 hours. We're looking forward in the year ahead to talking to some other interesting folks. We're sort of in conversation with Bernie Horn at Polaris Global Value, some interesting guys domiciled in London, and even the person most likely to join the River Park lineup, David Berkowitz, who is, as far as I can tell, not actually a mass murderer, but instead merely shares his name. Mr. Berkowitz, a distinguished hedge fund manager who Morty has now lured into the light side. And so all of that is in the months ahead. We hope that you've enjoyed your time tonight, that you've learned and profited from it, and we promise to keep you informed as our developments come along. Again, Morty, Mitch, thank you for the time. I really do appreciate what you've offered folks.
Thanks, David. Always our pleasure. Have a good night.
The conference is now concluded. Thank you for attending today's presentation. You may now disconnect.